Good afternoon, Council. Ready to proceed?
Good afternoon. May it please the court. David Eagle from Claire Harrison, Harvey Brandsburg, and Ellers on behalf of the defendant below and the appellant Niagara Falls Holdings, LLC. I have requested 3 minutes of my time to be reserved for rebuttal. This is an appeal from a Chancery Court opinion in order granting the summary judgment to the plaintiff below, the appellee, Eureka. And until the date of that order, Holdings, Niagara Falls Holdings, was a co-equal 50% member of Niagara Falls Redevelopment, LLC, with equal voting rights, equal profit sharing. While not a managing member, Holdings had important management and approval rights in NFR. And Holdings' 50% interest in NFR has never changed. It's never been assigned in whole or in part. It's never been encumbered. As a result of the order, however, Holdings has been divested of all membership rights. It is frozen in NFR, which I mean by that it has no ability to invoke the only exit provisions in the party's LLC agreement or to seek dissolution in the courts. It no longer has any management rights. Nor does it have the ability to, at this point, to complain about Eureka's denial of information regarding NFR's acquisitions or its operations. Indeed, at this point, Holdings is relegated to the rights of an assignee under the LLC Act with a bare economic interest until such time, as Eureka in its discretion chooses to pay dividends or distribute sale proceeds, if at all. I'd like to address three areas. The remedy imposed by the Chancery Court, which is in fact no remedy at all, but a new right implied in the relationship between these parties, granted Eureka a new right to remove its co-member, which was not negotiated at the bargaining table, nor is it found in the LLC Act. I then would like to address the four alleged breaches of the transfer and control provisions of the agreement between the parties, which the Vice Chancellor held warrant for forfeiture of Holdings' membership rights in NFR. And time permitting, I'd like to address the dismissal of Holdings' counterclaims for dissolution and breach of the buy-sell provisions of the LLC agreement. Again, prior to the
committee. I don't want to distract you too much from your order, but it would be helpful to me if you could tell the court what you think should have happened with regard to Kogan's death. With regard to that particular breach, assume there were no other breaches, he just died. And what do you think would have happened?
Justice Holland, to answer your question, the passing of Mr. Kogan was not only foreseeable to the drafters of the LLC, it was actually foreseen, and it was included within the provisions. As we know, the LLC agreement states that Mr. Kogan had to have had exclusive voting control, and his family has to maintain at least a 51% legal or beneficial ownership in Holdings. And then there's some unusual language which says that it's a breach, even if it's outside of the control of Mr. Kogan or his family or any member. But as a result of that, no damages can be awarded to Eureka, to another member. And the question is, what does that mean? On this summary judgment record, undeveloped, the Vice Chancellor had to draw inferences from that. And what I think, the inference was drawn adverse to Holdings, improperly on summary judgment, that this negation of a damages remedy opened up the door to a whole panoply of non-damages remedies, whether a common law or otherwise. What I think should have happened, to answer Your Honor's question, is that there were a couple of choices. Eureka had the choice to try to deal with another manager of Holdings at that point. I mean,
But my question really focuses on your client's perspective, because one way to look at this is say, all right, and we have four alleged breaches, but the one that looks like it's fairly significant is Kogan is dead. And that's something that transcends the agreement, even if we didn't have the other three breaches. So realizing we have that fourth breach that's significant. Why don't we just address this from the point of view of what the parties contemplated pursuant to the agreement would happen if Kogan died? So my question to you is, Kogan's dead. What did your clients think would happen under the agreement?
They believed, as I understand it, that a successor would take over holdings, whether it was Mr. Kogan's son who worked with him, as the record shows, closely in the development project, or somebody else. The appointment of a new representative of holdings is not contingent upon Eureka's approval. However, I understand that Mr. Kogan has to maintain exclusive voting control. If he's dead, his performance is excused as being impracticable. That's our position. Now, our client believed that they should participate in adding value to NFR.
I'm sorry, is your answer that if Kogan dies for the reasons that you've just explained, there's no breach and nothing happens? There's no legal effect?
Well, there is. The agreement does, Justice Jacob, the agreement does state that the death of Kogan is a breach.
All right.
It does. Now,
Then what is the remedy?
The remedy is, under this agreement, if the parties have not negotiated some consequence flowing from that breach, then Eureka must be able to show some kind of adverse impact on NFR, some kind of damages resulting from Kogan's death. That would be the appropriate measure of damages if it existed. Certainly on this record, there's no showing of any adverse impact on NFR by virtue of Mr. Kogan's death. Now,
well, I guess my question is a little more nuts and bolts. If Mr. Kogan died, voting is going to take place. Your client used to have input when Kogan was alive. And would there be an interim successor, or what would happen on a day-to-day basis until they work this out?
That's it. Excellent question, Justice Hahn. I mean, on a day-to-day basis, Mr. Kogan did not have management.
No, I understand. I understand.
So clearly the record shows that, first of all, Niagara Falls Holdings, my client, did not initiate this litigation. They responded to this litigation. They sought to participate and appoint a representative, an interim representative, Nick Kogan, who had Mr. Kogan's son, who had been involved in the project before, and sought to participate and add value, not to run away from the project and to just get its money out and run. It's not an inference that can be drawn from the record at all. So I think my clients would have tried to, as they did, participate in the management, realizing they have a duty to not only, the duty goes beyond themselves and beyond their debt. The duty goes to the entity itself, to holdings, and to holdings' only asset, which is its 50% interest in NFR. It had a duty to maximize that value.
I may be asking the same question, but it is troubling to me. Assume for purposes of discussion that all of the breaches found by the trial court were determined to be breaches of the agreement. What remedy do you contend is the appropriate remedy?
Given the fact that the parties could have easily drafted a remedy, but did not, the answer to the question is most likely judicial dissolution. If the agreement cannot be performed in accordance with its terms, because if in fact Eureka felt that it was impossible to continue this venture without Mr. Kogan alive and as a backstop exclusive, as an individual backstop in voting control, then the remedy would have been the only remedy that is appropriate, where there was nothing else specified, nothing else was negotiated at the bargaining table. It would be dissolution of NFR. That would not be, as Eureka argues, a reward for holdings. The holdings would thereby lose the upside potential of the venture. It wouldn't be, and it wouldn't be a punishment against Eureka. Eureka, and we argued in our briefs, and it was not contradicted, Eureka had the ability, to, the financial wherewithal, to buy the assets of NFR, take an assignment of NFR's rights.
Mr. Eagle, two questions. Sure. To follow up on Justice Berger's, your position is that if all four of the breaches that were found to be breaches are upheld on appeal, then the remedy is dissolution. Do you draw that conclusion from the text of the LLC agreement or from some other source?
I'd like to, Justice, I'd like to amend my answer to some extent.
Not only dissolution, another alternative. I believe, actually, this is a point which is discussed in the Star Cellular case, that another possibility, as I mentioned before, would be damages, in fact, if there was an adverse impact on NFR. So there are two choices. If there's no adverse impact on NFR, which we submit there was not, and certainly on this summary judgment record, there's no showing of that, then there would the only remedy would be dissolution, and that's because it's not, as we see it, driven by the terms of the LLC agreement. It has to be driven by as a default provision under the Act, because there's if Eureka cannot get along with a successor to Mr. Kogan, and I might add that the record shows that that Eureka was willing to get along with a successor of Holdings, of Mr. Kogan, and they instituted the lawsuit in order to compel Holdings to name a successor that was appropriate to them, and there's correspondence.
So the answer to the first question is that it's driven as a default provision under the Act. That is, yep. It's the Act that's the source of your answer.
Yes.
Okay. My second question really goes back to the one that Justice Holland asked, which assumes that the only breach in the case is the death of Kogan. The question is, what is the remedy in that circumstance?
The remedy for the breach of Kogan would be damages, if they can be proven.
But, notwithstanding the clause in the LLC agreement that says that the Kogan's death will not give rise to a right to damages?
Well,
I mean, where does that come from?
Yeah, well, we don't know. We don't know what the drafters meant by that phrase. I mean, when the drafters said, except the death, provided that the death of Kogan would not constitute, would not enable a party, entitle a party to damages, perhaps they simply meant there's one party will not be penalized as a result.
Well, perhaps they meant that, but perhaps they meant exactly what the language says, in
Correct.
Which case you have two choices. One is nothing, no remedy, or equitable, some equitable remedy. Which is it?
That's correct, Your Honor. The remedy would be, dissolution. If it indeed led to a situation where the parties were not able to continue with the venture and with the project.
And is that also drawn from the Act itself rather than from the language of the agreement? That is that bottom line?
I believe it has to be, Your Honor, because I don't see that having been addressed. And that's one of the fundamental problems here with this agreement, is that the consequences flowing from the alleged breaches were not addressed in the agreement itself.
Okay, so if I understand your position correctly, it doesn't matter whether there was only one breach or whether there were two, three, or four. The remedy is the same, dissolution. Unless some adverse consequence that can be quantified can be shown, in which case, at least apart from the death of Mr. Kogan, there might be a claim for damages. Or maybe your position is that even if there is... even if Mr. Kogan's death is included, there would be a remedy for damages.
I think Your Honor has correctly stated our position.
In other words, your position is, if we just continue to focus on Kogan's death, that if the entity was going to continue, if Holdings was going to continue, your client should be able to participate as a full member. And if they weren't going to be participating as a full member, there had to be a dissolution. The problem with this remedy is that your client has no rights, but they also have no benefit of their money because there hasn't been a dissolution.
That's correct. That's correct. The appropriate remedy for Kogan's death would be dissolution, as I've stated, because it would be literally impossible to carry on the business of NFR in accordance with the operating agreement. They contemplated Kogan's death when drafting, but they didn't provide for loss of management rights as a result, although they could have easily done so. The onus is on Eureka to ensure that the right of dispossession of Holdings is reflected in the agreement. These are sophisticated parties drafting a complex operating agreement.
The parties did, however, negotiate for a consequence in the event of a full assignment by Holdings of its interest in Niagara Falls. Is that correct?
A full assignment.
That is a traditional legal assignment.
If Holdings had fully assigned its interest in NFR to a third party, yes, that would trigger a loss of membership rights.
Which was the remedy awarded here.
That's correct.
And suppose that rather than having a formal assignment of that interest, that there were a series of acts that took place that resulted in the same, that have the same economic result and legal result without being called an assignment. If that were the case, if that were established, then wouldn't the agreement be the source of a similar remedy, which is in fact what took place here?
I don't agree with that, Your Honor. I'm looking for the language in Article 9 on where there would be a triggering of the loss of membership rights. The parties have drafted precise language, and in order to remove property from a member, the drafting of the provision has to be precise. And if the drafting of the provision calls only for a traditional assignment of Holdings' interest in NFR as a trigger for loss of membership,
it doesn't say traditional assignment, and it doesn't say formal assignment. It just says assignment. And I guess to recast my question, if the assignment, if what happens here is a result of these various breaches is an assignment in substance, albeit not in form, why shouldn't the same remedy attach?
Because there are a couple of responses, I think. Because, first of all, the parties were very careful about drafting prohibited transfers under this agreement. They stated that an assignment of Holdings' interest in NFR would constitute a prohibited transfer, and then they drafted a provision, a definition of indirect transfers, whereby a transfer of an owner of an interest, a transfer of an interest in an owner of Holdings, one level upstream from Holdings, would also be prohibited. They were careful to limit the prohibition to one layer removed from Holdings. Not only Holdings' interest in NFR, but also the interest in a person who owns an interest, which is an owner of Holdings or an owner of Eureka. Well, Eureka has different transfer restrictions. Well, that language would be superfluous.
Well, that goes to the question. Doesn't that argument go to the issue of whether by virtue of these upstream transfers, there were breaches that occurred other than the death of Mr. Kogan?
It is relevant.
Okay.
To that inquiry, yes.
My question assumes that those breaches are established. Making that assumption, if the net bottom line effect of those breaches, including the death of Mr. Kogan, was to affect in substance an assignment of Holdings interest in Niagara Falls, then doesn't the agreement create a foundation for the remedy that was awarded here?
My response has to be no, Your Honor, because the Act provides, the General Assembly has stated in the Act itself that LLCs are to be privately ordered, they are creatures of contract, and before one member or a court can dispossess another member, those provisions have to be, those consequences have to be drafted with precision in the agreement. And there is, and it is not enough to say that, well, the function, it's functionally the same, or it's substantively the same, that it's form, that it's substance over form, because then we are getting into a situation where, and I believe that the transfer provision, the transfer definition, is relevant, because the parties only precluded one level upstream from Holdings. That language would be entirely superfluous if a court was permitted to look at the second degree upstream or the ninth degree upstream or the seventh degree upstream and say, well, let's look at it in substance, not in form. Are these shell entities? Are these is the effect the same? Is it a foundation? That is not, I believe, under our law, given the primacy of contract, the private ordering of LLCs, that cannot be the that cannot be the right result.
Okay. So your position, and this will be my last question, is that when the language speaks of the language of the agreement uses the term assignment, we have to interpret that to mean formal assignment, as distinguished from, let us say, a series of acts that amount to an assignment in fact or in substance.
Yes, sir.
Earlier in your argument, you were suggesting, I believe, several times that the fact that this was decided on summary judgment is significant, and that discovery wasn't completed and all the facts weren't developed. What would discovery potentially add to the analysis here?
I see that I'm in my rebuttal time, but may I answer?
Sure.
The discovery would have added some possible intent that the drafters had in as to the consequences of the death of Mr. Kogan, as to the consequences for an indirect transfer. It may have added more information about Eureka's breaches of the agreement of the buy-sell provisions, which preceded the two last breaches in chronological order, the death of Kogan and the alleged breach concerning the receiver. Discovery could have turned up equitable factors that would militate against Eureka's claims. In fact, when was Eureka aware of these breaches, these alleged breaches? When was it, when was it aware of these, was it aware in the year 2000 when the restructuring proposal was implemented, and therefore is the statute of limitations barred, a bar to their claim?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Andy Bouchard for the appellee, Eureka. In reading the appellant's brief, Oshanter's brief, I was struck by the unusual order in which it presented its arguments, and again, by the way, it was presented in oral argument today. And I say Oshanter very deliberately because that is the real party in interest on this appeal. That is the creditor that is behind Holdings right now on this appeal. Oshanter started both briefs, and it started its argument today, by focusing on the remedy the Court of Chancery appointed, and then only as a secondary matter went to the issue of breach. That order, I would submit, is counterintuitive and was done very deliberately. It was done to divert attention from the fact that Oshanter conceded below not just one, not just the Kogan death breach, but two breaches of the LLC agreement and acknowledge that really the only issue in this case should be the issue of remedy.
Well, help me understand what I'll call a normal set of facts to put this case in perspective. Let's assume hypothetically that there was an actual assignment and there was a breach. And as a result, pursuant to the agreement, membership rights were forfeited. Then Kogan dies. What do you think would have happened under those circumstances? Would the entity holdings just have continued with the loss of rights, tough luck for Kogan's heirs, or what would have happened when Kogan died?
Well, I think, Your Honor, by the way, there's a yellow light on here already, so I'm assuming somebody's going to
I didn't want to interrupt you to tell you this, not to panic, but I noted that the clock was not set up correctly when I started it, but I know the time that you have. You'll have another 20 minutes.
Thank you very much. I think, Your Honor, in your hypothetical, number one, if there was already a breach and membership rights had been taken away, one would wonder, well, what cumulatively would be the value of any other further remedy being put into place for Kogan's death? And I'm not sure any further remedy would or wouldn't make sense in that circumstance.
That's from your client's perspective. And now from Kogan's side, can Kogan's heirs do anything, or is it just tough luck for them?
I think
could Kogan's heirs force a dissolution?
No. I think the only way you can – in fact, that would be the exactly inappropriate case to force a dissolution. You have a circumstance where it would be acknowledged, in a, as you put it, a real assignment. I assume what you mean is a primary-level assignment
exactly.
That would trigger the provision,
right.
You know, typically in the LLC Act, that you would lose your membership rights. There would be absolutely no reason in that circumstance that any subsequent person would have a right to force a dissolution because it would be very much practicable to carry on the LLC. But what I want to make sure is...
So you agree then that with your opponent that they are frozen in NFR, at least until 2048?
Well, I don't know that they are necessarily frozen. Lots of things happen in commercial transactions. I don't think they have a right to trigger a buy-sell provision, and I certainly don't think they have a right to trigger a dissolution. But there are many times when people go into investments in that very circumstance and they order their affairs and have a private negotiation to get an exit mechanism. That's the proper mechanism that would apply here.
Right.
And that is, I think, what the parties contemplated here.
Let's assume there was no assignment and we just have, you know, smooth waters. Kogan dies.
Yes.
What do you think would happen?
That's a very interesting hypothetical, and I think that it really depends on the facts at the time. And I want to deal with that in two parts. The first part is, let's assume it's not Kogan, but let's assume it's Donald Trump. Because basically, Kogan was Donald Trump for this venture. He was the guy that conceived the idea of building on this large tract of land in Niagara Falls. He didn't have the money, came to my clients to do it. But they extracted very important rights over control of management and very important rights over what he could do with his interest. So if he died and you had Ivanka come forward, you may say, I'm okay. I'll deal with that. I can deal with that. She knows something about this. That's a person I can deal with. But if he dies, Donald Trump dies, and he puts up, I forgot the name of the model, was his first wife, but if you put up somebody that was less to your liking, you may not be willing to do that. I think that's very dependent on the circumstances that would apply as to whether or not that's a business proposition that would make sense to my client in that circumstance.
All right, let's assume if the son that your client doesn't want to do business with, what happens?
Well, in this circumstance, and this is what I think is really important.
But I don't want to talk about this case. I'll get back to this case once I understand a less complicated case, which would be smooth waters, Kogan dies, your client doesn't want to be in business with the heir.
Yeah, well, then I think we are in a circumstance where, in the discretion of the court, the remedy exactly that was applied in this case should govern. We should have the right to continue our venture. They continue with all economic rights, not losing any economic rights here, but they lose their role in management. Now, why do I say that? Well, 2.9 could not be clearer. It states, at all times, Edwin Kogan is supposed to maintain personal control over holdings, at least 51%, and his family, at least 51%. That's right there in 2.9. And it's right there in 2.9 that it would be a material breach if he dies. We can't get damages, but obviously the implication of that is that there are other remedies that apply to material breach. Now, what I would like to do, if I could segue from that, is say, now let us look at this case, because there's a lot more than just his death. We have a circumstance here where the two other breaches that go hand-in-hand are very important. We have a breach of a security interest representation, or basically a breach of Section 9.1b because a security interest was obtained by Oshanter. And then the bookend to that is we have a receiver that's now come into play at Oshanter's behest. Oshanter went out and got this receiver. They took possession and control of the shares of 83 Corp., which by then held the controlling interest of holdings in July of 2004. They have now said this is the person in charge of 83 Corp., Jonathan Krem, a principal of Oshanter. You deal with him. So now we are being forced to deal with a creditor of the Kogan Trust whom we never did business with, and that's supposed to be the partner that we're hooked up to. So there's a lot more here than just Kogan's death. Because of the security interest breach, as well as the receiver breach, the net effect is that the very purpose of the provisions that were put in place is being violated, namely that we're being forced to do business with a stranger that we never picked to do business with. So I think it's far more, Your Honor, than just Kogan died, even though that is a simple, isolated case. It is also the security interest breach. That, by the way, was the second of the two breaches that was conceded below. Now, there's an effort on appeal to try to withdraw that concession, and I think you probably saw that in the briefs, but frankly, it doesn't make any sense. The security interest breach violated two provisions of the LLC agreement. It violated Section 9.1b because there was a security interest given in holdings when the Kogan Trust pledged all the assets it had, which included its interest in holdings. And then it violated 9.2, which is the provision requiring certain information be filed with NFR whenever one of the triggering events had occurred. Neither occurred here. In the briefs, you'll notice that the other side says, oh, we only conceded below to violating 9.2. Well, frankly, that makes no sense, because you would not make a 9.2 filing unless there was a transfer that fell within 9.1b in the first place. It was a flat-out full concession that there was a breach when the security interest was granted in October of 2001. Your Honor, I'm anticipating a question.
I'd like to go back for a moment, Mr. Bouchard, to Justice Holland's initial question, which is what happens if there's smooth waters and then Kogan dies? And I thought your answer was that in that circumstance, the result would be the same as what actually occurred here.
I think the outcome that occurred here would be appropriate in that circumstance if a partner was being forced on Eureka that was not to its liking.
All right. And what is the source of that answer? That is to say, the agreement itself doesn't specify that. It just negates one possible remedy, which is damages. But it leaves open a range of others.
Yeah.
Why this one?
I think that the source clearly is the equitable discretion of the Court of Chancery. And I want to squarely address that. It is correct that this agreement does not squarely provide a remedy for exactly this breach. It rules out for the death the breach of damages. The clear implication, however, being that if you're going to have a breach and you've ruled out one, that there are others that are available. I don't know of any agreement where somebody foresees every remedy that would apply for every breach. The other side's position is if it's not in the four corners of the agreement and if it's not in the statute, you're basically out of luck. You get nothing. Now, that would, number one, have the effect of rewarding somebody that breached the agreement, which I submit is not the appropriate way to go. They shouldn't be rewarded. Holdings shouldn't be rewarded for having breached the agreement. Some remedy should apply.
Well, their argument is, if it's not in the agreement, you wind up with a dissolution. And that's one of the sub-implications that we have to consider in this case. Everyone talks about LLCs as the right to contract, and you can do all these things by contract. And yet, in this case, we have a court looking at the party's intent and crafting a remedy. So, at least philosophically, we have to come to grips with whether we can still craft equitable remedies when there's a breach of an LLC, or if the parties haven't contemplated a remedy, is the default remedy exclusively judicial dissolution?
I think if anything but judicial dissolution as an exclusive remedy, you go really to the discretion of the Court of Chancery. And I want to make 2 points on that. Number one, I think an important provision to keep in mind as the authority for going to basic principles of equity is Section 1104 of the LLC Act, which says, in any case not provided for in this chapter, the rule of law and equity, including the law of merchant, shall govern. That is basically just embracing the point that when there's a gap and it's not addressed and a remedy is not specifically applied for in the contract or it's not applied for in the statute, there's not a specific remedy that governs, you go to those basic rules of equity for application. Gotham Partners, Your Honor's decision in that case several years ago says exactly the same thing. So that's the authority of where you go. It's the discretion of the Court of Chancery. Now, dissolution, I guess theoretically, could be among the panoply of remedies that the Court of Chancery would consider, but it would be highly punitive to my clients in this circumstance. Number one, Eureka would lose its entire investment or the opportunity, the upside of this this venture, in which it has contributed $32 million as of June 2005 and is the only of the two members, initial members, that ever invested a nickel of cash. $32 million. It would lose the upside. It would be gone. That would be the consequence of judicial dissolution. Second, the entity itself would be harmed in ways that would not be appropriate. Now, Oshantu as a creditor may not care, frankly, if they don't maximize value for NFR. It has a security of $800,000, a security interest of $800,000 or thereabouts it wants to cover. But my client cares very desperately about the value of the entity. What happens in the event there's dissolution? The city of Niagara Falls has the right in that circumstance, and you can bet yourself dollars to donuts it would occur because these properties have appreciated in value immensely in 10 years, to buy back all the properties that were purchased by NFR at 1997 values. All the appreciated value goes away. In the brief, there was a lot of minimization of this harm, characterizing it as just a $500,000 issue. That's not the case. The case is that the city of Niagara Falls can buy back all the properties that were bought with $32 million of my client's money at 1997 values, and in addition, can demand back $500,000 of a premium that was paid in connection with those properties. So I think you go back to discretion of the Chancery Court and say, what makes sense here? And I think when you look at it, what makes sense is, all right, they breached these provisions, you know, here to Sunday a couple different ways. There's really no meaningful factual dispute on that front, or if Your Honor have any questions, I'd be glad to address them. But there's really not. At the end of the day, there are breaches. They're clear. Two of them were conceded. What makes sense? The court picked a middle-of-the-road approach. It balanced against the idea of an economic forfeiture not calling for that. You know, there are provisions of the LLC statute that say that if you go into bankruptcy, you lose your interest. You don't just lose your membership rights, you lose the economic interest. We didn't seek that. The court didn't give us that. There was no forfeiture. On the other hand, it's not going to let somebody breach the agreement with impunity. So it picked the middle-of-the-road course, and it said, in that circumstance, you won't have your membership rights, you won't have the say in management because Eureka didn't sign up to manage the business with Oshantu, but you will have your economic rights under the agreement. And that, Your Honor, I submit, was an appropriate exercise of discretion. And incidentally, I think a key point that's really not addressed with any authority contrary to the ones we pointed out is that that should be an abuse of discretion standard. There is clear authority in Gotham Partners that when a remedy is applied by the Court of Chancery, that is evaluated for abuse of discretion. And there certainly is no abuse of the discretion of the court here in picking that middle road approach.
Well, you talk about it as being a middle road approach, but I think earlier on you acknowledged that under the circumstances that are in play right now, the practical result is that the parties have to negotiate an exit strategy. I think that's the way you termed it. In other words, Oshantu is going to be bought out, right?
Oshantu will be bought out, or it will continue to let us put this venture together and make some money. I mean, that was the idea in the first place. And let's go back for a second.
But wait a second.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
If you're talking about Oshantu being bought out, Oshantu has no negotiating ability here because Oshantu has no rights other than its economic rights.
Well, Your Honor, I think that's a lot of negotiating leverage, having economic rights in an LLC. But the point is that's the way the parties ordered their affairs to begin with. We didn't ask them to breach the agreement. They only get to exercise a buy-sell when you have membership rights to exercise a buy-sell with. The fact that they breached the agreement to have the effect of relinquishing their membership right really isn't our fault. But to be clear, if they wanted to exercise the buy-sell hypothetically, they could try to exercise the buy-sell. Yeah, I think we'd have an open debate about whether or not that's a permissible act because they have lost their membership rights at this point. But the point I really want to drive at is the parties organize their affairs in the first place, not to permit somebody just to pull the chute willy-nilly and have a dissolution. To have a dissolution, you've got to go through and establish under the statute that it's impractical to carry on the business affairs of NFR, and it's not.
Well, but I understand why, from your perspective, a dissolution is not an appropriate remedy. But does that necessarily mean that the remedy that was chosen is an appropriate one? Isn't it possible that there ought to be something that, for example, provides for the buy-sell option or something like that, so that if the parties are no longer going to be operating together, they're not left with one party at the mercy of the other?
I think, Your Honor, one in their discretion may consider other options than what occurred here, but this option, I think, was a measured response that the court took that frankly finds its inspiration in the statute itself, in the assignment principles that when you assign your interest, you lose your membership rights. They go away. And it's consistent with that. And the philosophy behind that, which is in the Ribstein treatise, it's in the Milford Power case, and it's in the statute itself, is that there are certain things that ought to be freely transferable, like economic rights, but you shouldn't be able to transfer management rights. And there should be a cost if you try to do it. And the cost is you don't have a say in management. You'll keep your economic rights. So the remedy that was applied, you can always think of a different one, was really one that was in sync with the statute, with the case law, and it made perfect sense. I really don't think we should be playing a violin for Oshanter here when it's the one that, knowing about this agreement, incidentally, there's an affidavit indicating it understood this agreement when it went into this investment, basically was lining things up to be a breach. They're really in no position to start dictating terms that we ought to now rewrite the agreement to have exit mechanisms that were never negotiated in the first place. That would really be turning, I think, basic principles of equity around.
Okay, but you also indicated that if all that happened here was that Kogan died, that you think that this would be an appropriate remedy. And,
yes.
And at that point, you would lose the ability to argue that, you know, somebody acted inappropriately. The guy died. And the agreement doesn't really provide what's going to happen then, other than that it's a breach. So this is the appropriate remedy.
I was a little more qualified in my response to say that would depend, you know, I'm doing your hypothetical now,
right,
removing the Oshanter facts, to say that, well, really would depend on who they tried to appoint. It, back to the Trump example, if it was a good person we could live with, we'll work with them. But if it's a person we can't, I think that would be an appropriate remedy in that circumstance. And it was contemplated that that would be a material breach right in 2.9 of the agreement. That was the protection that we obtained for ourselves when we negotiated the agreement.
But if that were the facts, that is, if the only breach was that Mr. Kogan died, then by your argument, the court would have the discretion to select that remedy among a menu of other equitable remedies. That is, it wouldn't be required to grant the remedy that, in fact, was granted here.
I think the court would have discretion to grant potentially any number of remedies,
right,
and that would be reviewed on an abuse of discretion standard.
Right. But your position now, or I should say your position as a consequence of there being these other breaches, is that that discretion got narrowed. Is that correct?
Well,
yes
and no. Clearly, because of the other things that happened, I don't think there's any question that the ultimate remedy that was awarded here was appropriate because of those additional factors. But let's remove those other factors. Here, we didn't know exactly who was doing it at the time, but it ended up being Jonathan Krenn. This Oshanter principal tried to appoint Nick Kogan as the person to be at least a representative. Doesn't have any legal authority, but then the figurehead of Holdings that we would talk to. Nick Kogan himself put an affidavit in this case, and it's referred to in the brief, saying he didn't even have the expertise to be involved in managing NFR. Now, certainly, even if he just had the death, and that was the one track they had, it's going to be Nick Kogan, forget about Oshanter, forget about the security interest, I don't think it would be appropriate that that would be the person we'd be forced to do business with, and that the remedy would be appropriate in that circumstance, just on that narrow fact.
Mr. Bouchard, you asked for a five-minute warning. You have 4 minutes left.
Your Honor, I'm really at the point where I think I've covered the points, believe it or not. I think I've covered the points I want to get across. Actually, with one exception, let me go real quickly to the buy-sell provision to just make a couple of points, if I could. The issue on the buy-sell, just so we understand it, is that there was a counterclaim brought alleging a breach of the buy-sell provision. That's the context that appears here. And there was an argument made in the briefs that I just wanted to respond to because we didn't have a chance. It was in the reply brief, so I just wanted to add this to make it clear, that Section 9.6, the argument was made, doesn't have to just be triggered by a member. Well, I think that's just plainly wrong, and I wanted to give you two reasons why that's wrong. One is that when you look at 9.6, it consistently talks about a membership interest or an interest uppercase, which is the same thing. So on its face, it's talking about triggering the sale of a membership interest. It would make no sense, frankly, that a buy-sell provision would work in an asymmetrical fashion where somebody could sell something less than a membership interest and the other side of the equation would be a membership interest. That just wouldn't make sense. And second, there was the point made with respect to 9.6 that was not just a right to rent to a member, but it was a right that was personal to Holdings. And that, too, is plainly wrong. And I just refer the court to Section 9.6C. When you look at 9.6C, it clarifies that it defines an offeror, the person that can trigger it, on the holding side of the equation, as Holdings or the Holdings group. And Holdings group includes permitted transferees. So it's wrong to say that that it ran just personally to Holdings. It very much ran to Holdings or permitted transferees, which we don't have here. That was the only additional clarification I wanted to make. Absent your honors, any other questions, those are the points I wanted to make.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honors. The picking up on one of the last comments that Mr. Bouchard made about the expertise of Nick Kogan, which was one of the affidavits, I mean, that was the basis for, according to the record, for his joining forces with Oshanda Development Corporation. And I think it's a good indication of what discovery could show in this case. I mean, did he have expertise? When he joined forces with Oshanda, was there sufficient expertise? Was there intent and was there plan to actually run this and gain benefit out of this venture and not simply take their money and run, which is the assumption which is being made, but there's no basis for it. I'd like to briefly address the claim that there were two breaches were conceded in this case. I mean, that we absolutely reject the suggestion that the breach of the Oshanta lien breach, as it's termed, was conceded. The concession was only as to the lack of a document under Section 9.2, which evidences evidences a transfer. There was no such document. I see that I may have run out of my time. Thank you very much,
counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.